Space art and a snapshot of the space economy. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Astrophotography combines science and art, capturing the wonders of the universe through the lens of a telescope. At a recent public telescope viewing and astrophotography exhibit, the Orlando Museum of Art and the Central Florida Astronomical Society, or CFAS, held a cosmic celebration for attendees to explore the universe with a space photo gallery. We'll speak with CFAS's Frank Kane and the Orlando Museum of Art, Coralie Clayson-Gleason, of the astrophotography exhibit. Then the space industry had a very successful year in 2020. But now that we pass the first quarter of 2025, how is the space economy this year? We'll speak with Space Capital's Chad Anderson about how companies like SpaceX, the new presidential administration, and technology like AI are playing roles in the new space economy. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Using telescopes and cameras, astrophotography is just one way that people bring space and art together. While giant space-based telescopes can take some stunning images, a backyard telescope can capture some pretty incredible pictures too. During a recent telescope viewing and astrophotography exhibit, the Orlando Museum of Art and the Central Florida Astronomical Society, or CFAS, hosted 65 astrophotography images of things like our solar system, eclipses, and stellar nurseries. We first spoke with Coralie Clayson-Gleason about the event and the importance of bringing exhibits like these to the public. Here's part of a conversation now.
So today at the museum is our Access for All Day, which is a free day once a month where we're able to open to the public for free. And so today it's very special. We have CFAS, the Central Florida Astronomical Society. And they're presenting so many different programs. So starting from a pop-up photo exhibition, and the exhibition will be free tomorrow as well. Actually, it's in our free space at the museum. And then there was a beautiful lunchtime lecture with Frank Kane on art and science, really. It was, looking at the cosmic perspective. We have hands-on activities, and of course, we have the beautiful observation deck outside on the museum plaza with, I think it's 4 or 5 telescopes being set up. And we're currently looking at the sun. And during the nighttime, when the sun sets, we'll be looking at the stars as well.
You mentioned that this is kind of a blending of art and science. How important is that for your organization here to highlight the sciences along with the incredible art that you all do?
It's kind of expanding people's minds, really, that nothing is black and white. It's not art on one side and science on the other. And Frank made a beautiful lecture at lunchtime where he explained, that both of them, in those beautiful scientific photographs that you see, there's always an element of art and vice versa, and when you look at art as well, there's an element of science. When you think about the colors that are chosen and how they're made, and even color pigments and things like that, there's always, the two disciplines actually merge and mix, and it's not a clear boundary between the two. So it's important for people to see that, I think.
I know you have a background in art. Did you learn something new today?
Every time I'm with CFAS, I feel I'm learning something new, and that's also why we want to highlight them, really, because there's something about being accessible. And actually, this is the name of our day, it's Access for All. But what they do, it makes something that seems unreachable, actually reachable. Catalyst for me, that very first trigger when I met them was that they had set up some telescopes outside of the Emil Bieler Observatory in Seminole State College. And I was able to just see Saturn right here from Earth. And I think that was the catalyst to me. I thought, oh my goodness, I can't believe I didn't know you could see this right here. And a lot of what's surrounding us in here in this exhibit is actually the same thing. They're actual real people who live in Orlando and around Orlando and that are capturing images that are worthwhile, worth of what you see in NASA.
I'm glad you mentioned that Saturn, because that was my eureka moment too. I looked through a telescope at the Emil Bieler Planetarium. Mm-hmm. It is pretty wild. It gives you a sense of place. But that's what art does, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, is this exhibit doing what some of the other artworks that have been privileged to call this place home? Is it inspiring your guest as much as any other art would?
You use the right a word, inspiring, you know. It's the idea that there's something bigger, greater, and that there's always another level of understanding, you know, that it's not all down to one simple object. There's greater knowledge out there, more things to imagine and discover. And I think that's both an element of art and science. There's more to discover.
That was the Orlando Museum of Art's chief curator, Coralie Clayson-Gleason. I also had the chance to walk through the exhibit with Central Florida Astronomical Society's president, Frank Kane. We talked about the images captured by members of CFAS, both professionals and amateurs. Here's part of our conversation. Well, Frank, just start by telling our listeners where we're at right now.
Right now, we're inside the Orlando Museum of Art in a special exhibition showcasing astrophotography from our members of the Central Florida Astronomical Society.
There are dozens of images here, right? Can you give us a range of what is captured and displayed here?
Yeah, in total, we have like 65 images here on display, and they do capture a range of subject matters. So over here, we have solar system photography, so pictures of the moon and the sun that were taken. And some of them are pretty interesting. You know, we have photos of eclipses that are happening, solar eclipses and lunar eclipses that are happening over time. And we also have a very large selection of what we call deep sky astrophotography. So these are long exposures, 20 hours or so, of distant nebulas and galaxies that are out there. We also have a few examples of what we call sea star images. And these are showing what you can do with low budget equipment. You know, you can just buy this off the shelf for a few $100s, plunk it on the ground and let it go. And you can still get some pretty cool images from that. Finally, we have some nightscape photography and some launch photography as well, kind of showcasing some of the members that are into that.
Tell me a bit about your members. Who are they? Are they professional astronomers or are these amateurs that have telescopes and do this for a hobby?
It's all of the above. So we have a really mixture of people in the club. So being close to Kennedy Space Center, we do have a lot of professionals in the organization as well, but mostly we're amateurs. You know, we're just enthusiasts who bought their own telescopes and either observe with our eyes or observe with our cameras like we're seeing around here today. So we have the full gamut of people within our club on every level.
I want to hang out here in the solar system and talk a bit about how some of these images are captured. There's some gorgeous photos of the moon here, including a total eclipse there. How would an image like this be captured by one of your members?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're doing. So for things like an eclipse, that obviously requires a fair amount of planning. You got to be in the right place at the right time for sure, and really think about what the exposures are going to be ahead of time. But on the other hand, a lot of these pictures are really easy to take. So for example, we're looking at some that are just people taking a cell phone and smashing it against the eyepiece of a telescope. And for something like the moon, it's bright enough to pull that off, and you can get a pretty decent image that way. So it can be as easy or as hard as you want it to be.
What about these over here? These look a little more intense. These are galactic photos. What am I looking at here?
So this is the sea star section here. And again, this is showcasing what you can do with really inexpensive entry-level equipment. And we're looking at a couple of things here. Two of them are what we call nebulas. So these are clouds of gas out there within our own galaxy that are thousands of light years away. We have there the Eagle Nebula, which is the Pillars of Creation you might have seen from the Hubble telescope as part of that image. And above it, we also have a galaxy. That's the Cigar Galaxy. Again, just showcasing that even with a modest piece of equipment that's actually, you know, not very big, just a few inches tall, you can actually capture these galaxies that are tens of millions of light years away.
And how do you do it? Can you walk me through the process?
Yeah, I mean, with these C-Star devices, they're really cool. Like, basically, you just plunk it down, make sure it's leveled, and push a button. And it will automatically find the object that you want to image after you select what it is, and basically send it a stream of that image to your cell phone. And the way it works is what we call stacking. So we'll take a series of images of this thing over and over and over again and add them together in software. And over a period of time, like a half an hour or so, you end up with an image like we're seeing here today.
Could something like this be captured from a Central Florida backyard?
Absolutely. You know, if you give enough exposure time to an image like this, you can overcome the light pollution in Orlando. Obviously, the darker the skies, the better. You know, the darker it is, the faster you can get a good image. But you can see a lot, you know, even in the middle of Orlando, with all of its light pollution.
And so over here we have more of what seems to be kind of nightscape or landscape photos, right?
Right, nightscapes, which is kind of a genre of landscapes. So, you know, just like landscape photography is an art form in and of itself, so are nightscapes. They're landscapes at night. So you're seeing a lot of images here that have a picture of the Milky Way galaxy in the background, usually positioned strategically to be in a place that gives you good image composition. And there's some really beautiful stuff going on here just from dark sky locations. So with a fast enough camera lens and a dark enough place and a beautiful enough place, you can really pull off some really beautiful beautiful nightscape images.
And obviously this is not a lot of this is taken in Central Florida, right? Very difficult to see the Milky Way here.
It is, although it's not impossible. There are some dark spots within Central Florida as well. So for our own astronomy club, the Central Florida Astronomical Society, we have a site in Geneva, Florida that's darkish. You know, you can see the Milky Way from there for sure. But there's also locations like the Kissimmee Prairie State Park, or if you get around the Big Bend area, it's pretty dark there as well. So you can definitely get away from the lights in Florida if you know where to go.
I want to head over to the launch photography. This is the stuff that I'm more familiar with here.
Yeah.
These are all very cool. Again, these are also taken from your members as well?
Everything in here is from our members. Some of the planning that goes behind these launch photography shots is just incredible. Like we have that shot there from John Starr, and we're looking at a picture of a Falcon 9 rocket going right in front of the moon. I mean, you know, it's hard enough to know where the moon's going to be at a given moment in time, but a Falcon 9 rocket, I don't know how he does it.
Yeah, these are all really, really cool. And now, and just to the left of them are these beautiful, beautiful color images. What are we looking at over here?
So now we're going into the deep sky section of the exhibit here, where we're seeing a combination of nebulas and distant galaxies. And these represent really long exposures, often of 20 hours or even more in some cases. So the trick here is that you need really good equipment that can track these objects as they move across the sky at night, and then again, combine those images together in processing later on. But what you're gonna see are these beautiful images of these illuminated clouds of gas in space. And they're just, you know, formed by stars blowing out the gases around them, and oftentimes there are areas of new stars being born, areas of star formation. And we're also seeing some pictures of galaxies here. Again, these are tens of millions of light years away. So you're literally looking back in time, tens of millions of years when you look at these images. It's pretty cool.
Where does the color come from?
It depends on how you process it and how you take the image. So there are some artistic choices you can make when you're doing deep sky astrophotography. So a lot of these nebula images are using what we call the Hubble palette. It does the same thing the Hubble did. Instead of imaging these things in their natural colors, we're using special filters to say, okay, here's the light that's been ionized by sulfur, and here's the oxygen that's been ionized, and here's the hydrogen that's been ionized by the stars around it. And we map those different ionized gases to different color channels, red, green, and blue. So what you're seeing is a false color image in most of these cases, but they're giving you some scientific information about the chemical composition of these clouds of gas as well.
It seems to me that this is very technical, but also there is a little bit of art and creativity that goes into this, right? Does it take a special person to do astrophotography?
You could say that, but that's why we're in an art museum, right? You know, there's definitely a blend of science and art when it comes to astrophotography, and there's kind of a spectrum, right? You know, when you're taking a picture of the moon, it's more science, more technical, a little bit less art. For things like deep space astrophotography, you do have more choices in how you map the colors, how you frame the subject, how you orient it, and things like that. So definitely getting more toward the art side there. And then we have, you know, the nightscape stuff. Absolutely. Landscape photography, of course, that's art.
Do you have any of your images here?
Oh, my favorites are over here. So down here on the bottom, we have what's called the Sol Nebula. And I'm proud of that one because it actually represents 70 hours of total exposure time, obviously done over many, many nights. So the detail in there is something I'm really proud of. And you get a lot of color depth because with that much exposure time, you can really pull out the details of the gases in that nebula and get a really pretty image.
That's absolutely gorgeous in there. It looks like, you know, there's some pillars in there. This is where stars come from, right?
It is, yes. There's new stars being formed in the middle of it, and the wind from those new stars are kind of pushing out that gas around it and leading to these really cool-looking shapes that surround it.
And some of these are kind of a zoom out, right? These, I'm looking at galaxies, but they're much smaller in the entire frame, right?
Right. So to the left, we have what's called the Leo Trio, or the Leo Triplet galaxies that we're looking at here right now. This is a collection of three galaxies that just happen to be very, very close to each other in the sky in the constellation Leo. And they really are close to each other. They're interacting with each other gravitationally. But what I find really cool is that every one of those three galaxies, you're looking at like 100 billion stars in there, and probably 100 billion worlds that are looking back at us potentially. But again, you know, 20 to 30 million years in the past.
This is the first time you're having this exhibit here at the Orlando Museum of Art. What's been the reception so far?
It's been pretty amazing, actually. Like, you know, people are asking some great questions, coming through here, getting inspired. That's why we're here. You know, that's the mission of our organization, to spread our love of the cosmos and astronomy.
What do you want people to take away from looking at these photographs when they're here?
Personally, I hope people come away with what we call like a cosmic perspective, you know, realizing that the universe is a vast place and we're just a little piece of it. When you think about the scale of the cosmos, it can help you realize that some of our problems here on Earth are maybe petty in comparison.
That was the president of Central Florida Astronomical Society, Frank Kane. Thanks so much to CFAS and the Orlando Museum of Art for hosting us for that segment. Still to come, the future of the space economy and the uncertainty that lies ahead.
There's so much going on in the space economy right now that it's so dynamic, and there's these leapfrog technologies that are coming online. You need to be paying attention to how they're going to change things.
That's just ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. With new missions and technology that will come online like SpaceX's Starship and the possibilities surrounding AI technology, 2025 is shaping up to be a big year for commercial space. And under the new administration, SpaceX could play a huge role in the growth of the space economy. But what role will economic uncertainty, especially tariffs, play in the future of this industry? Space Capital, a seed venture capital firm, released its predictions for the rest of 2025 and what we've seen so far in the first quarter of 2025 in the Space IQ quarterly report. Here to talk about the report and data is Space Capital's Chad Anderson, founder and managing partner at Space Capital. And a quick note, Anderson is an investor in SpaceX. Chad, welcome back to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
Hey, Chad, before we talk about Q1 of 2025 and what's to come this year, let's take a quick look back at 2024. From your standpoint, what really defines that year when it comes to the economy of space?
From a macro perspective, it was starting to see things turn around a bit, right? So we had, coming off of the zero interest rate period, the run up in 2021 where capital was cheap, saw a lot of money sloshing around, a lot of companies getting funded that maybe shouldn't have, investors paying crazy high prices for things. That all peaked in 2021 and things, the market corrected over the next couple few years. Right. So 2022 and 2023 were difficult years for VC investment for startups, just generally across tech. And that certainly impacted space companies as well. In 2024, we started to see things turn around. There was a bit of optimism. You know, we were coming out the other end. A lot of the irresponsible investing of the 2021 period kind of had worked its way through. There was a few stragglers, but for the most part, we were through all of that and we were starting to come out the other end. And there was some optimism. You know, people were starting to file for IPOs. The public markets were in good shape. So actually, 2024 was a decent year in terms of investment dollars that were going into this category. In terms of optimism, again, technological progress continued. Now we started to see the investment come back. So 2024, you know, we ended on a high note. And we kind of went into 2025 thinking it was going to continue. There was a lot of optimism, certainly in the financial markets, you know, with the new administration coming back in, thinking that they were going to continue the policies and the emphasis on space that they did in the previous Trump administration. So the financial markets were happy about that. We started to see things, you know, a few of the space stocks, their price popped, and all of that sort of came crashing down over the next couple of months of Q1 as we started to see tariffs, immigration policies, and some other things really spook investors and increase volatility. So it's been a whirlwind.
How has that affected the space industry in, you know, the previous, you know, few weeks since those tariffs were put into place?
So again, we went from a lot of optimism. We saw space stocks surge in early January, but most of those gains have been erased. And we're starting to see several major financial institutions indicating that there is an increased likelihood of a U.S. recession. They're citing pressures from the administration's tariff and immigration policies. So, and this was actually, you know, before the tariffs went into place. You know, again, we're coming off of a difficult few years and the hangover of the zero interest rate period. A recession would be really bad for startups, for investment. We're already starting to see some of that play out. Could get worse, it could get better. Obviously, larger companies that are well capitalized are going to be able to weather this type of storm. But for startup companies that are really relying on this revenue source from these government contracts, really in a lot of cases betting the farm on it, those go away, that could cause some existential risks for folks.
Is there concerns with already established companies or established startups about, you know, sourcing and supply chain because of these tariffs? That's something these companies are thinking about moving forward?
Again, we're still early days. Look, I mean, China has, they control the rare earths. And as this trade war escalates with China, things are starting to get pretty heated. And as they do, you know, I mean, I think it was yesterday, the day before, we saw China threatening to stop the supply of rare earths. There's less importing, exporting of space systems. That hasn't happened. But certainly components, rare earths and other things are, there is a global supply chain for these things, right? The idea is that through these tariffs, that a lot of that will be onshored. I think that some of that was already happening already. Various defense organizations in the government were interested in having our satellite companies and our other infrastructure companies do more of that in-house, less bringing in solar panels from other areas, including Asia. So, you know, I think some of that was happening already. That's the idea, is that we'll, you know, build some of that, more of that capability in-house. But in the short term, there's certainly going to be some pain.
It's not all doom and gloom, though, as we see in your Q1 look ahead here. Even with this administration and the things that we have just been talked about, you expect a greater focus on promoting the space economy. So space companies do stand to gain from the next 4 years of this administration, right?
Yeah, I mean, the same geopolitical instability that's undermining public markets is also driving national urgency around space resilience. So defense is going to be a key driver of growth going forward. You know, while there's cuts across departments in the government, something really interesting happened this quarter where the Space Force was set up as a new branch of the military, and, you know, they were calling themselves Guardians. And the idea was that, you know, it was very sort of defensive, and they were guarding the orbits and making sure that the orbits were safe and that we could continue operations, safe operations there. That changed in Q1, where they came out with a new doctrine that was basically saying that space is a domain of warfare, that the U.S. is going to take not just a defensive, but an offensive posture in space. And the reports that China was practicing quote unquote dogfighting maneuvers in space prompted the U.S. Secretary of Defense to say that, you know, there's no way to ignore the fact that the next and most important domain of warfare will be space, and that you're going to see a lot more investment from this administration into that domain, both offensively and defensively. You've seen that play out in the Golden Dome initiative, you know, the missile defense proposal, where a lot of money is going to be made available. In Europe, obviously, there's a lot of solidarity happening with trying to decouple themselves from the U.S., given the rapidly changing geopolitical order, although that's going to be easier said than done. So defense is certainly a key driver. And then another key area that we're watching very closely, and where we've been spending a lot of time and energy and been investing our capital, is in geo-AI. So geospatial intelligence and artificial intelligence. Basically, we've got SpaceX made access to orbit much more affordable and much more accessible to launch satellites. We launched a ton of new sensors on top of decades of archival imagery of this really valuable data about the surface of our planet. It's been too much information for humans to comb through and make sense of. So unless you run it through an AI system, and if you run it through an AI system, you can now start to drive useful insights from it. And we're starting to see that. And we saw a bunch of developments in geo-AI from some large established tech companies working with some new startup companies. And we think that's going to be a huge area of growth, not just in Q1, but going forward.
One of the things that's mentioned in this, orbital traffic, right? There's a lot more stuff going up. And this report says, you know, the coordination of orbital traffic is going from elective to essential at this point. Why is that important?
So if you look at a graph, a plot of the number of satellites launched to orbit over time, it's pretty much a straight, you know, flat line until 5-6 years ago when things really start to take off. It's not even exponential growth. It is now super exponential growth. The number of satellites in orbit is growing faster than exponential. It is growing faster than Moore's law. The doubling time of the number of satellites in orbit is now every 18 months, something like that, right? So this growth is basically a straight line up. And all of that was based on the Falcon 9, you know, SpaceX's workhorse rocket. But we are seeing Starship now come online. And Starship is a much larger vehicle, fully reusable, so it will be launching more often for a much lower cost. Starship comes online and launches 5 to 10 times more satellites than we've seen. So somehow that straight line up is going to get even straighter. You know, and what does that mean, right? So space is big, but at the same time, you want, you know, a lot of companies are trying to go for the same orbits, right? So there's some junkyard orbits up there where we launched a bunch of stuff and it's now defunct and it's sort of in orbit. And so you have to avoid those. If you're using Earth observation satellites, you want to stay close to the Earth. Launching Starlink satellites or other communication satellites, you want to stay close to the Earth for latency purposes. So a lot of people are going for the same orbit, which means that, you know, if we want to put more satellites up, we need to operate much more safely and effectively, because if one satellite, you know, crashes into another one, it causes a bunch of debris, which then goes and causes a bunch more debris. And that's, you know, Kessler syndrome. It's like the movie Gravity. So you want to avoid that at all costs. How do you do that? You know, first you need to understand where things are. Leo Labs is a company in our portfolio that's been doing that, you know, for a while now. Then once you know where things are, you need to start coordinating between actors, right? You need to not just get an alert and then send an email or pick up a phone and call somebody. We need to leverage some new technology to be able to do some machine-to-machine orbital maneuver optimization so that we can all work together, so we can avoid collisions, so that we can save on fuel. So this is an area where We have deployed capital where we think there's going to be the future of the space economy is dependent on our ability to maintain safe orbital operations.
Finally, Chad, one thing in this report that definitely snagged my attention was the future of PlayStations. And this is definitely not something that I play Fortnite on, right? This is, we're talking about commercial space stations. So tell me a bit about the outlook for those.
Well, it's pretty interesting. So we've had conversations, like at the moment, the International Space Station is set to be decommissioned in 2030. There have been calls from prominent folks to bring it down earlier. There are commercial space stations that have been funded and are building commercial replacements. In a lot of cases, these are essentially built in the same way that the International Space Station was, but using venture dollars and maybe at a smaller scale. Problem is that the space station costs, you know, $150 billion and costs $3 billion a year to maintain. So it's not exactly a model that works well with private capital. We believe that this is a representative example for the leapfrog technology that Starship is and how it's going to change things. So we've seen a lot of capital go to what we call emerging industries. Actually, commercial space stations has received the most amount of capital in the emerging industries because it's really interesting and exciting. And we've seen a lot of uninformed capital go into this space. But there's not a lot of government dollars that are being made available for commercial stations. And also, when you think about, you know, where the money's going to come from and what does the future of space stations look like, Starship is a vehicle that is massive. I mean, these are big vehicles. They've got the volume inside of a station. So it kind of makes you call into question whether or not you need a permanent station in orbit at all. Could you use Starship as a station? Could you fit it out with whatever equipment or whatever hotel amenities you wanted and launch it with the people inside and bring it back down? Got the up mass and the down mass covered and cut out the middleman, and then you've got a tailored, custom, bespoke experience for whoever's using it. So it's really interesting to think about this in terms of, you know, it's easy to get excited about the shiny thing, but you got to be paying attention. Like the space, there's so much going on in the space economy right now that it's so dynamic, and there's these leapfrog technologies that are coming online. You need to be paying attention to how they're going to change things, right? And how it's going to accelerate growth in certain markets, and how it's going to create entirely new markets, and how it's going to make some existing infrastructure obsolete.
Which is why I'm glad we have you on the show to talk about all that stuff. So thanks. Chad Anderson is the founder and managing partner of Space Capital, a venture capital firm focused on investing in the space economy. He's also the author of the book, The Space Economy: Capitalize on the Greatest Business Opportunity of Our Lifetime. Chad, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do it on the Central Florida Public Media app, the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. Our handles on Instagram and Facebook are at AWTY space. Are we there in space? Get it. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, please reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.